Today, the CEDIL has the great pleasure to welcome Professor Rosamund Mitchell. Good afternoon, Rose.
It's a pleasure to be here. Good afternoon.
So, Rose Mitchell, you are an emeritus professor of applied linguistics in modern language at the University of Southampton. But before starting your academic career, you were a teacher of French in a lower secondary school. When I look at your impressive list of publications and the research project you've led, I see that you often make the connection between second language acquisition research, on the one hand, and second language teaching and learning, on the other hand. And this is a central issue for the CEDIL, but it's, I feel, not always easy to make this connection. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit from your experience how to best connect, make this connection between research and practice, if you have some good advices or if you, what is your experience about this?
Thank you. That's such an important question for both teachers and researchers. And it's a question to which there are different answers. For example, there's a fashion in my country at the moment for telling teachers that what they do should be evidence-based. But there always seems to be an assumption that somebody else has done the research somewhere else and that there are just results out there which need to be applied universally in classrooms. And of course, that's actually an attack on the professionalism of teachers, because teachers are always operating in a unique context with a particular class, with a particular set of children, a particular context, a particular set of considerations. It's always unique in some sense, and teachers have to have the freedom to find solutions that work well for them with that group of children. So there is always a tension between the wish of researchers to generalize and the actuality of teachers' lives, which is that things are always, in a sense, particular and new and different. And so that's a major issue that we all have to be aware of and humble about, if you like, when we try to build connections between teaching and research. I mean, my opinion is that we need to start at the very beginning, that in teacher education itself, we need, on the one hand, to equip future teachers with some understanding of theory and of the empirical results that, in our case, have come forward about language learning, and particularly, of course, language learning with instruction. So that they have some basic knowledge that research has been done, that there is research out there. But we also, I think, from the very beginning, need to give teachers a chance themselves to think about how to test ideas and how to innovate, but then to evaluate innovations in their own practice and in their own classrooms. So we shouldn't intimidate teachers that the only kind of good research is big scale, generalizable, statistically based with large numbers of schools and participants. Teachers need to understand that research is also valuable when it's local and when really it just feeds into the improvement of local practice and local experience. So we need to have that kind of climate in our teacher education, in our teacher development, where teachers are expecting, as professionals themselves, to innovate and to evaluate their work, to reflect on their work, to report on their work with others, and so on. I mean, I'm talking here, I suppose, about what has been labelled in the research literature action research, but research that's close to classrooms has to be respected also by professional researchers, if you like. Basically, we need both kinds of activity, and we need a good dialogue between them, because it's in that climate where teachers themselves are reflecting on what they do, sharing what they do, that they will actually be interested in the professional research and what generalizations professional researchers are drawing in their slow, cumbersome way, okay? I mean, there are major issues about how teachers could better access research literature. There are some interesting projects happening about making research more accessible to teachers. So some of the research journals now are part of what is called the OASIS Initiative, which is supposed to provide, you know, user-friendly versions of research studies that are accessible to a wider public. I'm involved myself in the UK in a similar project, but which is focused particularly on the primary school. We're trying to collect evidence about effective primary practice and make that available to primary school teachers in a readable and easy form. But you cannot say that just providing literature is the beginning and the end. Clearly, there has to be a climate in which teachers want to read. It makes sense for them to read. And theirs is not really a reading profession. Teaching is very much an action profession and a personal reflection profession. So this needs constant activity, constant attention. Head teachers need to lead. University managers need to make space in teacher education for teacher investigations. Lots of players have to be involved, and we also have to be willing to accept uncomfortable results. You know, we might say to teachers, "Oh, research has shown, let us say, that the communicative approach is the right way to go, or task-based teaching is the right way to go." But if a teacher says it doesn't work for me, do we just say to them, "You are wrong because research has shown this work"? How do we engage with them to say, well, let's innovate on your level? How would you address the same questions, the same issues that these big movements have addressed? What solutions can you find? And you may well find that, you know, teachers come up themselves with ways to adapt their practice, but also the method that is suggested to them, so that actually it's more effective with the particular clientele, the particular customers they are dealing with. So it's a long-term project and something we have to continually work at. And we need, you know, a real sense of who is the teacher as a professional. Are they just a technician implementing, you know, styles of teaching pedagogies, curricula that somebody else devised? Or are they actually somebody who should be engaged constantly in the improvement process and in the, if you like, the critical evaluation of what we are doing? And then again, teachers need to have space, time, resources for reflection, which in many school systems they simply do not have available to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for this very interesting answer. I think often we think that as researchers, we should, in a way, function as advisors for teachers who want to do research. But I think that the teacher also have something to learn us, researcher, let's say, you would agree on, yeah. So often at the beginning of the term, I ask my students, my future teachers, how do you think we best learn a language? And they are quite unanimous about the fact that it's immersion. Mm-hmm. And I know that you have conducted this very large study, a longitudinal study with students who went abroad to use their language in a country, in France, for example. So would you agree with my students and saying, yes, immersion is the best way of learning? You have to go to the country, you have to be immersed in the situation to really learn a language? Or would the picture be perhaps more nuanced, let's say?
Well, I mean, I would begin by saying that, you know, excellent though the immersion experience may be, most students will never have the opportunity to do that. So we cannot get out of thinking about how do we make classroom learning effective by the notion that, well, actually learning will, or the polishing of learning, the superior learning will happen somewhere else. I mean, the classroom is fundamental to language learning in our society, and the classroom has to be a satisfying place, an emotionally comfortable place to be, a challenging place to be, an interesting place to be, but above all, a place where students have a sense of progression and a sense that they are, you know, they know more now than they did a month ago or 6 months ago. So the classrooms themselves have to be led by a clear strategic vision. There is a lot of evidence that, yes, a grammar core is a necessary part of successful progression in the classroom, but that has to be delivered with lots of practice, lots of communicative use, lots of recycling of language, lots of revisiting, around interesting and engaging topics and activities. And we cannot get out of it by saying, well, what can I do as a teacher? Really, the students would be better off if they weren't my responsibility. It's not really, you know, it's understandable as a naive attitude at the beginning of the process of becoming a teacher. But I would be very worried if your students were saying something like that at the end of your training, and I'm sure they have changed at that point. However, we are very committed to the idea of naturalistic exposure, and of course, in a sense, your students are quite right. It is not possible to learn a whole language in the classroom. The classroom experience is in some ways very rich, but in other ways very impoverished. The social group is very limited. You're with your friends and a teacher. You're not meeting you're not engaging in the wide range of uses for which, you know, we do use a natural language in the real world. So there is no doubt that an experience in a society, in a culture, in a context where the language you want to learn is commonly spoken is really helpful. It gives you rich experience, rich exposure, above all to different language styles, different language situations, different types of text, from informal technological uses to the media, to just the signs you see in the street, to the chats you have in service encounters, to the academic exposure you might have in a university. So yes, a stay abroad can offer an extremely rich language learning experience. But at the same time, our research shows very clearly that students do not benefit from that experience all to the same extent, that there's nothing magic about geography. There's nothing magic about simply catching a plane or a train and spending 6 months in a different environment. Students benefit to different degrees, and our research suggests that is actually not just a matter of the context in which they find themselves, but has to do with who they are, who they want to be, and how self-aware they are themselves of their learning while they are there. Actually, in Europe today, the notion of immersion is a myth, because any major European city or any major European higher education institution is a multilingual place and an international space, where there are economic migrants, refugees, academic tourists, if you like, exchange students, flowing through. And so a student who travels to France expecting to hear only French, or to Germany expecting to hear only German, is going to get a shock, right? That means that there are always language choices. If you want to speak your home language while you are abroad, you will find contacts. If you want to speak some other language that you enjoy speaking rather than the local language, you will always find contacts. And of course, their English is a major issue, because as such a widely spoken lingua franca, there's always the option of English among locals and visiting students, or between visiting students themselves. There's always this possibility. So what we have to think about is, how do our students, the people we would send abroad, how do they navigate this multilingual space? How do they clarify for themselves their goals, why they're there? And what can they do about achieving those goals while they are there? So we need to prepare them beforehand, so that they are actually thinking strategically about issues like, who am I going to live with? What kind of friends would I like to make, but how am I going to meet them? Another interesting question, I think, is it really the case that I must, my preference may be to spend my time with my own age group, but is that really going to be the best from the point of view of language learning? Are there ways I could engage with the society by getting to know older people, by getting to know retired people, by working with children? Are there, you know, volunteering roles, service encounters I could engage with? Are there sporting activities I could get involved with? But reflection on and planning and thinking about these kinds of issues is a very important part of the students' preparation before they go, so that once they are there, they have a sense of the different possibilities that are open to them, some of which will be disappointing. It's actually tough when you are a foreign student to make friends with local students. They have their friends already. They see foreign students come and go. Why should they be interested in you? What are the strategies for making yourself useful to them? Can you offer a language to them in exchange for the language you want to learn and make tandem friendships? Can you be a very competent person in class that everybody wants to work with in group work? You know, there are avenues through which you can develop relationships with local students, but they need thinking and they need planning. And again, what are the options for living? In some countries, it's much easier to live with locals than in others. For example, in our own study, it was much easier in Spain or in Mexico to live with local people than it turned out to be in France, where international students tend to be put in the international residence with other internationals. And that had consequences, actually, long-term consequences for the friendships and the integration into the culture that those different people experienced. So if you're in France, what do you do instead? You have to, these are issues about students' self-confidence, students' willingness to take risks, students' agency. In turn, the educational institutions who send students abroad have to think carefully about how to prepare and support students through all those choices. Some universities help students plan before they go. Increasingly, we see initiatives where students are supported while they are abroad, perhaps by an app which every week asks you to reflect on what did you do this week? Did you make a friend? Did you have a conversation? How did you get on in your academic courses? There are ways in which people can be supported, but ultimately we have to, the student who gets the most out of the time abroad is the student who knows why they're there, knows what they're trying to achieve, and navigates their way through their online language practices, their face-to-face language practices, their media use, all the rest of it, so as to, on the one hand, be emotionally supported. So we all need to talk to mum, once a week or whatever it is, to be emotionally supported, and friendships with one's own national group are important for that too. But on the other hand, given a certain level of emotional support, how can you use that as a platform to move out into the new society, to take some risks, and form new relationships, perhaps with pensioners or helping out in an after-school homework club. I mean, our students in our research found amazingly diverse ways of integrating that we could not have predicted for them. But in terms of what educational institutions can do, it's the preparation, it's the assistance with reflection on yourself as a learner, the attempt to build the autonomy of the student that is going to help them to make the most of the experience. Mm-hmm.
So now I come to a last question, which is about. So now you already answered a little bit that question in the previous question, but now in Switzerland we very much try to create immersive context in the public school, in the normal school. And I was wondering whether there are some lessons we can learn from a project like yours with the students being abroad in an immersive context, at least if they make use of it or not, it's another thing. But and do you think that there could be lessons learned? Yes, for immersive approaches in public school, for example.
Well, there are many lessons. though obviously my research was not directly on the school age, on the with adolescents, so it was with students who were more self-aware as people, were at a different life stage. But I think in terms of, if you think of the different domains of activity, I mean, in terms of formal instruction and academic learning, there is the whole world of CLIL, of content and language teaching, so where lessons are delivered either bilingually or in a target language. CLIL has become popular in Europe, mostly as far as English is concerned. It's an interesting shift in the experience, because typically CLIL is delivered not by language specialists, but by subject specialists, teachers of maths, teachers of economics or whatever, who opt to use English over for their teaching. Now, of course, a lot of the research on CLIL has been with volunteer populations, so students can opt for CLIL and they don't have to do it. But nonetheless, the results are encouraging, that it seems that students can become much more comfortable and confident users of English and develop, a good command of the discipline-specific language through, you know, a fairly long-term exposure to CLIL. Though an important issue, I think, that this research has shown is that CLIL instruction does not replace the language class. The language class has to continue alongside. Okay, but if you are moving between a language class and a CLIL class, you really are in a position, even as a high school student, to get quite an immersive experience. Not exclusively immersive, because clearly, again, research shows that CLIL teachers permit exchanges in the mother tongue. How could they not? And so that explanations and so on may, and of course, they ultimately want their students to master the content, be able to talk about the content in two languages, not just in one. But even if there is a bilingual dimension to CLIL, CLIL teaching alongside a language course can produce extremely good results. So that's kind of the academic domain. But we're thinking about other domains. The English class itself could be a launch pad for a variety of, immersive experiences. The media are such a rich field. There is research out there about how people learn, again, it's English usually, through gaming practices, online gaming, video gaming, students who engage with these games often prefer to use the original language version of these games and actually learn language, teach each other language so as to become a competent games player. But then clearly there's I'm sure there's TV series, box sets aiming at teenagers. There's a wealth of media experiences. Now, do you spend classroom time on those, or do you use the classroom time to help students to discover what's out there and then set them tasks to accomplish out of class? You know, that would be a balance to be decided, but clearly the online world and the media world offers a huge array of rich input experiences, many of them targeting teenagers specifically. And a third dimension, of course, is how do you have, encounters with speakers directly? How do you interact with speakers? And once again, traditionally we had pen pals and school visits. But again, now digital twinning of schools and school exchanges over tools like Skype can be very effective in giving children insights into the life of, or adolescents into the life of their peers in another country. And I have in my own research seen some of this work in the primary school, where primary school children having direct insight into a French primary classroom find very compelling. Well, first of all, there's all the visual and cultural side of it. They're not wearing uniform, these kinds of things. But then how does the roll call happen? How do mealtimes work? All sorts of just the daily activities of the school, seeing what's the same, what's different. It's a cultural experience as well as a linguistic experience. But then on top of that, it's possible, of course, to exchange now to make little videos about yourself or your school, to exchange them. The technology has endless possibilities for getting virtual friendships and getting to know other cultures and the associated language without physically going there. So, I mean, Switzerland is a wealthy country. I'm sure you have much of this happening already, but it's making the classroom the place where you learn how to exploit all these other possibilities, and you get the motivation to undertake them, and then you report back or you discuss with your classmates what you found out. The classroom is the launch pad, can now be the launch pad for a hugely rich range of experiences. And again, there's much research that suggests that where these things are done, but again, with teachers who have the time and the resources to lead these kinds of projects and to make a success of them, there is a huge amount that we are very lucky today in the range of possibilities that we have to create what you are calling immersion at home, I think.
Mm. And there is certainly very much we can develop still also, yes. So thank you very much for coming to the studio and for sharing your experience with us. And I wish you a good travel back to Southampton.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.